You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows on our website, castaway.media.
It's Halloween. I guess everyone's entitled to one good scare.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
They're here.
Here's Johnny.
Hello, ghouls and boys, and welcome to Retro Asylum Halloween Special, where we hope to give you spooks and scares, with plenty of retro tricks and retro treats. Now on today's show, we have my fellow co-hosts, Matt Lamborn, aka The Mets, and Steve Erickson, aka Press Play on Tape. How are both of you?
Pretty good, mate, pretty good.
Yeah.
How you doing, mate? How you doing?
Yeah, oh, it's been a hellishly busy week for me.
Hellish, but, I like it. Hellish,
yeah, yeah, hellish. Halloween hellish, yeah. But yeah. It's good. I'm going to be off next week in Wales for a few days. Not the greatest weather, I admit, but we're going to be on the north coast, so I'm hoping there'll be some dodgy arcade with some classics tucked away somewhere.
I'm sure you'll have a fiendishly good time, mate.
Yeah, oh, no, I will.
Here comes the puns.
But it's been really busy for all of us, really, isn't it? There's been so much going on. I mean, should I go through some of the things I've been up to, or?
Yeah, do that.
When I went to see a film, nothing retro with that, but got a chance to have a look at the arcades there and, you know, saw Star Wars Battle Pod, and also very in line with this horror themed episode, there was a new arcade game called Dark Escape 4D by Namco. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
What
type of game is it?
It's really good. It's basically like House of the Dead type shooter, but you're completely encased in this in the cabinet, so there's like curtains that come down on the side, and it has 3D glasses in it, so everything's in 3D for you and a friend. It's two player, and the reason it's 4D is they're actually sort of blowing on your neck and rumbling the seats and doing all these other things to really put you in the action, and you're just
You're basically saying that you climbed into a booth, drew the curtains and got touched up.
Yes, basically. Yeah.
Probably should quickly mention this because it's the first time I think I've been back on since we won the podcast award.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Is this the first time you've been on since, Matt, or have you been on more recently?
Yeah, we did the episode I was last on, the FPS one, just before the podcast award. So, yeah, it's nice that we get to give ourselves a little pat on the back for that, and really appreciate all the people who went out of their way to vote for us. It means an awful lot to us, and it's a big shot in the arm for the retro community in general. So thanks very much again, and hopefully we'll be putting out loads more good podcasts in the next year as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just wanted to quickly mention that myself as well. I don't want to just to keep banging the drum that, you know, we've won an award, we're the best, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm sure people are getting fed up with us saying that. But, you know, it was down to our, you know, our community and our listeners and the people who voted for us that we won. So I think it does, you know, it is worth mentioning on, just to say thanks on behalf of all of us. You know, you guys are amazing. So we got to go and pick up the award and go down to Manchester. Unfortunately, Drisky didn't get to go.
I know. I was stuck at work, and I was looking at while I was working on some servers. I was looking at you were sending pictures of like champagne and really rubbing it in.
Yeah, we had one glass between us. It was that expensive.
Oh, you're all sharing it around, were you?
But it was good, you know. I mean, we went down to the Midland Hotel, I think it was, in Manchester for the ceremony, and we we really didn't know we were going to win, so it was like quite a shock when it, you know, we did actually win. Mm. But the night ended up as it always does with the Retro Asylum in beer and curry. but it was good. So there was me, Matt, Dean and Paul Davies in the end who got to go down. And like you say, we were just sending you pictures of where we were up to. But yeah, like I say, I mean, just don't want to keep banging on about it, but thanks to all our listeners. You know, you guys are brilliant. Thank you for voting for us. You know, and hopefully we can continue to be, you know, as good as you've made us and live up to that name now.
Absolutely. Just concur with what you guys were saying, that, you know, I see it as it's more of a win for the retro community as a whole, and just shows the passion of people. The fact that we were, you know, it wasn't just a retro video game category, we were up against modern video games. So the fact
we were up against PlayStation was one of them, and I work for PlayStation, so that was an awkward conversation with my boss when I got back into work.
You went na-na-na-na-na.
Yeah, yeah. I told you I was right. Retro's better.
But, it's wonderful, isn't it? So I suppose, actually, just one other thing I want to quickly add, just because I thought it was quite good. It's a new documentary called Nintendo Quest. Well, less of a documentary, more of a sort of entertainment thing. Have you heard about it?
No. What is it?
It's basically this guy sets himself a challenge using his own funds. So, you know, he's saved up for it to collect the entire retail collection of NES titles, the US, you know, so not the Famicom, but just the NES. So something like 640 titles in 30 days, but not over the internet. So he doesn't use eBay. It's basically a road trip with him and his buddy, who's a filmmaker. And it's very professionally done. It's not one that I would necessarily watch again, but it's nice they intersperse it with some very basic sort of Nintendo history. And it's just nice sort of seeing all these video stores. The guy lives in London, Canada. London, not UK London, you know, but also does a part of the road trip goes right into America and all, showing you all the sort of retro game shops there. So it's well worth sort of tracking down and giving a watch.
So I'll put the link. Find it? Okay.
Yeah, I'll put the link for it. Unfortunately, the Vimeo, the official link, which is the one I'll link to, where you have to buy it. And it is a bit overpriced, in my opinion. It's like £5.75 to rent, or £8 something to buy digitally on Vimeo, which is sort of a bit difficult with, you know, taking the plunge. It was a bit of a, you know, shall I go for this or not? But then not.
No, that sounds really good, though, mate. I like these little tips you give. In fact,
Well, that's why I just wanted to mention it. I watched it yesterday, and it was really, really good. So
I'll give it a go.
Give it a track down. But I suppose we've nattered on long enough. Is there any other bits you want to sort of mention before we go into podcast proper, the topic?
I think that's me sorted, mate.
That's cool. Right, okay, so what we thought we would do then, we sort of hit on an eclectic list of sort of games, but we didn't want to just go for the usual ones, and we didn't want to go, you know, like the common horror ones or like your Castlevanias, the ones that always get chosen. We just wanted to choose a nice eclectic range, not just scary ones, but Halloween-themed ones, things that you could also play with your kids as well as the more scary. And I thought it'd be best if we organise it. We all chose, I think it was three games each, didn't we? And we've got some fantastic listener contributions to add to the mix as well. So we've got loads of games to go through. But we thought we'd go through them chronological order, pretty much. So let's cover the first game, which was Cauldron by Palace Software and released in 1985. Personally, I didn't really give this much of a try back in the day because I had a Spectrum and I never found it that good. But I must say, after playing the C64 version, it's really, really good, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably a bit too young in general to remember too many games from this period of gaming, if you like. But for some reason, Cauldron's always stuck out enormously for me. I think it's as much to do with the awesome artwork that was flying around at the time, whether that be the stuff on the cassettes or what ended up in the magazines. But it was always that very iconic image of the witch with the massive nose, and she's stirring the cauldron, and it really struck a chord with me for some reason. It stayed in my mind constantly. So it's a game I've thought about a lot over the years. And the game itself is quite quirky and fun as well. I mean, for the uninitiated, Cauldron, it's a side-scrolling shoot-em-up with some combined platform elements, so it's kind of unique in that respect. And you play a witch who's looking to claim a golden broomstick from the Pump King. Very, very cute. The game itself's fairly basic. You're flying around looking for ingredients for the cauldron, and like many games of the time, it's really, really difficult.
You're telling me.
The learning curve on it is seriously off the charts. But Cauldron appeals to me because I really like the art style of the game, and there's something about these fantasy type games of the time where the imagination was so far ahead of its time. I mean, you don't really see games like this that often anymore, these kind of themes, certainly not regularly enough anyway, I don't think. But you mentioned, Paul, that the C64 version is clearly the superior version of this game. I've predominantly grown up playing the Spectrum version, which is quite clearly inferior. It lacks any kind of music in the game, and it suffers from some graphical flicker, but that doesn't necessarily ruin my enjoyment of the game. So I understand that Cauldron 2 is also very popular, and as whilst it's quite a different game to the original, it's supposed to be pretty good. So I haven't actually gotten around to trying that yet, but that's perhaps something I'm going to give a go for next Halloween. But what did you think of Cauldron, having had a go at the C64?
Yeah, well, as I say, back in the day I had the Spectrum one, which was like a flick screen version. And I just never really spent time with it, to be fair. I think I got it on one of the compilations, and it was just like never really gelled with. But putting on the C64 version, my word, when that music starts up, I'll play a little bit of it in the background, you're probably hearing now, that opening music, and it is the quintessential Halloween game, isn't it? She's a stereotypical witch. And as you say, that flying element of, as you say, the whole concept is you basically have to fly to basically rival witches' locations, or the six locations, to get ingredients. So as you say, you're sort of, for a large chunk of it, you're flying around trying to find these locations, and you can shoot magic, which you can replenish. And then you get inside a given location, and then it's that platform element where you're jumping around trying to find that magic ingredient. I think it's good, but my word, it's bloody rock hard, isn't it?
It got some stellar reviews back in the time, particularly from Zap for the C64.
And on the Spectrum as well. I mean, Crash gave it 91%, even higher than Zap. Mm. I suppose back in 1985, people were just blown away. They often said it was with the graphics. It was amazing. One thing to add, a little history with it. This did start out as a Halloween film license. They'd just done The Evil Dead in 1984, sort of similar team, some of the people sort of working on it, and they'd started to do Halloween, sort of makes sense, choose another horror, but this was around about the time of the Mary Whitehouse, the old Mary Whitehouse, where she was like, ban the video nasties, and putting a lot of pressure on, I think partly the official line is that they said they couldn't come up with a concept for the film, so let's do a more generic Halloween title. Although, and that's the official line from Steve Brown, the designer of the game. But I think it was to do with this Mary Whitehouse, and pressure was put on, should games be based on horror games and all of that. Even back in 1985, that was a hot topic.
She was a miserable cow, wasn't she?
She really was. But it was a great... do you remember the Mary Whitehouse Experience? That was a great comedy show. Do you remember that
one? Remember the name. I can't remember. I don't remember seeing it.
it used to be good, that. But what about you, Steve? What did you find with this?
Well, once again, I didn't play this back in the day. The first time I really proper laid eyes on this was when I was doing the digital version of Sam's book.
Oh, yes, yeah.
This Commodore 64 book, and that's when I first saw some screenshots of it. Now, obviously, as we've been doing it for the podcast, I've had to go with the specy version initially and just thought, this isn't great. then went on to the C64 version and was far more impressed with it once I had a proper go of it. I mean, it hasn't aged great now. It doesn't look like a brilliant Commodore. Even within the realms of Commodore 64 games, it doesn't look fantastic. But for one of the early Commodore 64 games, it's brilliant for what it does. You know, it's got great scrolling. It's actually even got great scrolling. It's even got a really small amount of parallax. I think it's the clouds versus the trees and the landscape moves at slightly different speeds. One other thing I like about it is the fact that it's really well programmed, because it's part platformer, part side scroller.
Mm.
And it's a smooth transition as well. If you land on the floor, you walk.
Although I always struggled landing on the floor. The amount of times I hit a tree and it was like, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah, I was trying to take off after you've been on the floor between the trees. I found that difficult. But, you know, it's
a great concept, though, isn't it?
It's brilliant. It's inventive, but it's bloody hard.
Yeah.
It's crazy hard. You mean it's slightly screw up, you're dead. Game over. But nice graphical style, loads of monsters. The setting's really good. It looks, proper like Halloweenish with the nighttime setting and the full moon in the sky. Crazy bad guys like bats, skulls. There's even sharks at one point in the water bit. You can see sharks' fins. And cracking music as well. Really spooky music. I think it's a good game.
Yeah. I don't say this lightly. I will say this in this case, the C64 version is better than the Spectrum.
Ooh, 8-bit wars.
I was thinking that this definitely should have been included in the 8-bit wars.
Yeah, you see, you needed to choose your titles, didn't you, for the 8-bit wars? Yeah. You have to make sure
you get Swainy on the case.
No, you can't let Swainy or Paul on the case.
and
Paul chose the titles last time. That's what went wrong.
And just for fairness, because we always get told off for not including Amstrad. They get very defensive. I had a go on the Amstrad version, and that was, in my opinion, not as good as the C64 version, but better than the Spectrum.
Uh-oh.
So I'm afraid, as a Spectrum lover, I found the Spectrum was the worst on this particular game.
Oh, well, that's the way it is for most games.
But having said that, the Spectrum had on side two Evil Dead. So Yaboo sucks to the other versions. Unfortunately, that was even worse.
Was better because it had another game in it.
But anyway, I mean, a great game to sort of start with, and as I say, top title. So that was a great choice there, Matt. So I suppose, shall we go on to a listener contribution?
Yeah, can do indeed.
Yeah. So I thought we'd play the first one, just keeping things relatively chronological, and we'll play our listener, Geeke. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And he's chosen an absolute corker of a title, Ant Attack on the Spectrum, 1983. So let's have a listen.
If I were to choose my most favourite retro horror game, it would have to be Sandy White's fantastic 3D Ant Attack. This 3D isometric game was released in 1983 on the ZX Spectrum and was probably the first 3D game I set my eyes upon. It's not a traditional horror game by any means, but it's commonly argued by some as one of the first in the survival horror genre. The gameplay is quite simple. You can choose to either play as a boy or a girl and enter the lovely isometric 3D city of Aunt Escher. Yep, ants and Escher combined. You must then rescue the opposite sex depending on this initial gender choice and lead them to sanctuary out with the boundaries of the city. It may sound simple, but with just a few clumsy bombs at your disposal, the game can be rather tough. The feeling of pursuit that many later examples of this genre do so well with is definitely present in this game. You feel the panic of being chased by the ants and feel the need to escape them. In your frantic dash, you make silly mistakes and quite easily get killed. Back in the day when I first played this, I remember feeling the fear and being chased by the ants. An anxious I got to get out of here fear. The closest I can describe this is to go to Resident Evil 3 when being pursued by the Nemesis, or Nemesis, whatever his name is. I mean, when he appeared in the room, you really felt, like melted toffee, and you just didn't know what to do. And you'd done silly things and random escape things and got killed quite often. Ant Attack is a gem of a game, and it really deserves its place in time as a numb traditional horror game that at one time did strike fear into the hearts of players. We were entertained back then, we most certainly were. It was more simple times, but I tell you what, give it a go, it's fantastic.
Yeah. agree wholeheartedly with that. Thank you. That was a great contribution by GK. He was a bit worried about his you know, broad Scottish accent and whether listeners would be able to be okay with it. But as I said to him, it's brought back happy memories of Games Master and Dominic Diamond. Very much that sort of vibe. Have any of you guys played Ant Attack?
Haven't played it, but have seen it many times and read about it in magazines and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing I'd say about that game is the guy who made it, what ambition and vision to try and create that on such a, you know, within the limited bounds of the platform that he put it on, you know, and to achieve it.
Yeah, I mean, 1983, this was just amazing. I mean, I remember this back in the day. It's one of my favourite games. Yeah, no, it is an absolute classic. And I always remember with this particular game, my cousin and myself, as kids, I suppose, being very, very cruel. But we used to make our own game version of this where we would we would basically find the prince or princess. And then instead of taking them to the exit like you were supposed to, we would go and try and take them to the highest point somewhere and then sort of encourage them to jump off the off into the ants. We would just come up with like the worst way of like killing the prince and princess, which is very macabre, but me and my cousin used to find that hilarious back in the day. I suppose simple times. But it is. It's an absolute classic. I suppose with modern, if you're trying to play it today, getting used to the keyboard layout and, you know, switching the views and what have you takes some getting used to. Particularly, you know, how to run along the isometric view, you know, the left is diagonally up, if you like. But yeah, absolute gem of a game and a great contribution and yeah, brilliant.
Big thanks to GK for that one.
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, I suppose should we go on to the next game, which is your choice, wasn't it, Steve? Which is Ghosts and Goblins, released in 1985 in the arcade.
Yeah, like you say, this was released by Capcom in 1985.
Yeah.
Now, the first time I saw this was, I was on holiday in Spain as a little kid in a place called Blanes. We used to go there, like, went there about two or three times with the family when we coach holiday trips because we couldn't afford to fly. And this big campsite, caravan site that we stayed on, there was a bar next to the pool at the campsite and there was a couple of arcade cabinets in it. And one of them was Ghouls and Ghosts. Now, I remember seeing this guy playing it and nailing it. He must have been five or six levels in, and for anyone who's played Ghosts and Goblins, they will know it's majorly super hard. Yeah, it's absolutely
notoriously difficult game.
So this guy was like, and I'd never seen it before, and this guy is like I say, he's like five or six levels in, and I think there's only six or seven levels in total.
Wow.
So he's proper nailing it. And from that point on, the whole of my holiday was just devoted to trying to beat it. I spent most of the holiday not near the pool, not playing in the pool, not playing with my brother, in that bar, not getting a suntan, just wasting all the little bit of holiday money that my mum and dad had given me on it. And did I complete it? Did I bollocks?
Did you get off level one?
I got near the end of level three.
Oh, wow, you did pretty well there. Well,
we were there for 2 weeks. It's not that impressive.
Yeah, but to be fair, even when I was playing this on free play, on my sort of X arcade, I struggled to get, I could get to level two and a little, quite far on level two, but I don't think I'm just rubbish at this game.
It's so tough.
You can sort of learn as you go on, though, can't you?
Yeah, well, there are some patterns to it.
Yeah, so I mean, they're all in the same places, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know where the bad guy's going to come up, and like, I mean, even like when you first play this game, like, it seems it's not too difficult for the first about a minute, and then there's a bit where you jump over a headstone, and there's a little red sort of flying demon thing sat there waiting for you.
Oh, Firebrand.
Firebrand. And you always lose your armour. On that bit, straight away. That's like 1 minute into the game. But for anyone who hasn't played Ghouls and Ghosts and Goblins, sorry. Mm. For anyone who hasn't played Ghosts and Goblins, and I don't believe there's anyone listening to our podcast who doesn't know what it is, but just in case there is. So it's a side-scrolling, sort of walk-in, slash-em-up, shoot-em-up. You play a knight called Sir Arthur, and he's got to defeat zombies, ogres, demons, cyclops, dragons, and other monsters, and try and rescue Princess Prin-Prin.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's a classic gaming trope right there. but she's been kidnapped by Satan, king of the demon world.
Yeah.
And as you play, you can sort of pick up new weapons, bonuses, extra suits of armour. Now, one of my favourite things in this game is the health system. Because basically, if you get touched by a bad guy, you're running along, you're Sir Arthur with your silver armour on. You lose your armour and you just basically start running around in your pants.
And what is it about that armour, though, Steve? You know, I mean, it's armour, well, for Christ's sake, and a bird hits it and it disintegrates.
It's not very well designed. It's like some kind of, like, got some catch mechanism that makes it just bounce off you at the first touch.
Now, the armour's beautiful, though, because you could hit it with a nuclear blast and it will protect you, but just one time.
And then it'll land in it. But it's brilliant, you know what I mean? It's just such a cool little way of saying you've got two bars of health, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
But in a really icon, you know, visual way.
And seeing him run around in his boxes is quite funny, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, that's like one of the first instances of, like, humour I ever saw in an arcade game. You know, I remember seeing in Golden Axe was another one. I saw someone complete it, and at the very end, the end sequence is a picture of the arcade machine and all the bad guys jumping out and running after the player.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It was one of them times again where I was just like, you don't expect video games to have a bit of humour in them.
I mean, the Japanese have a great sense of humour. I mean, this is, as you say, an absolute gem of a game, and it's one of those that, as rock hard as it is, you always can get that little bit further because of, you know, it's one of those you just learn. For those who love, like, you know, learning sort of placements of enemies and things, this is
attack patterns and enemy placements.
Pattern memorization, which I'm rubbish at, by the way. But the other trick is just keep on moving.
Yeah.
Don't try and sort of, because they're just like infinite enemies coming towards you, so don't get too caught up trying to kill everything. But one good way of playing it, if you're not going down the main path, is actually that, you know, that Capcom classic collection that you just picked up today, Matt?
Yeah.
The Play Expo, that's got this and the sequel on, so that's a great way to play that.
Beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But if you want, I mean, obviously it was a really massively successful arcade game, but it was converted to most of the computers as well back in the day.
Yeah.
And those versions aren't bad either. So, you know, I'm not going to get into another argument about the specky Commodore Amstrad versions. Commodore 64's version was okay. The Amiga had a good version. The Amiga version being a highlight. But I don't know, you probably do know this, that there's been a remake done for the C64. Called Ghosts and Goblins Arcade.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, and it's basically just improves on the original. It's like more faithful to the arcade version. It's definitely worth checking out.
I'll have to give that a go.
I subscribe to that Indie Retro News website.
Okay, I must give that a try. I mean, all the versions, you say, were pretty solid, really.
The NES had Ghosts and Goblins. That's where I cut my teeth on this particular game, and it's a really good version of it. And then you have the classic Mega Drive and Super Nintendo Ghouls and Ghosts, which are both brilliant, although slightly different. Yeah. Because on the Mega Drive one, you only have one power-up armour, as opposed to the SNES one, where you have the green and the gold suits. And there are other differences in there as well, but I think the SNES one's probably considered to be the absolute classic. And it's one of the more sought-after games on the console.
Yeah. It's certainly one that I can keep on coming back to with this. It's just so addictive, but so frustrating at the same time, isn't it? But you always feel it's always your fault. You never feel that it's being too unfair.
Well, it's instantly playable and instantly stupidly hard. But if you die, it's your own fault.
And the music is absolutely awesome. But the trouble is with the music, and I'm going to play the music video. There's this guy called Brentel Floss on YouTube. He's brilliant, by the way, very, very skilled. He does like a What If Video Games Have Lyrics series, and he did Ghosts and Goblins, where he's written all these lyrics and sings it. And the trouble is, every time I play the game now, all I can hear is that
the lyrics.
So I want to ruin and share it for everyone else and see
Thanks
what
for
you
that,
think.
Paul.
And goblins are coming for you tonight. They're gonna get you. Ghosts and goblins are gonna put up a fight. You gotta get through zombies and bats and dragons, and that's all just to begin with. Meanwhile, you're in your underwear. Yes, that diaper then. So do beware, cause they'll try to bite your wiener. Deedle-dee-dee. Just stick with it. Deedle-dee-dee. It's hard as shit. Deedle-dee-dee. You'll cry a bit. Scoop. Doo-dee-dee-bop. Doo-doo. The dead are coming for you. You and your gal were having a bite at night, some kind of picnic. That's when Satan abducted her out of sight. He's such a dick lick, he's gonna harm her. Too bad your armor's not even bird-proof. You're gonna hurt, dude, still and all. Your duty calls, so grow some balls and become a demon killer. You know this game's a thriller. Ghosts and goblins are dropping it like it's haunted on the dead. Are a Starther. Yes, it's hard. You will be scarred and probably charred. But baby, that's the way we're playing. Ghosts and goblins are popping the coffin tops. They're glad to eat ya. Ghosts and goblins aren't stopping until you drop. Don't let them beat ya. Satan is waiting. Go bifurcate him. Come on, you gotta. Don't stop for nada. A happy ending is inside. Ghosts and goblins are coming for you tonight.
This story is happy end.
Okay, well, I suppose let's go. We're going rattling through them here, but let's go on to the next one, which is my choice. And it's Splatterhouse in the Arcade, released in 1988 by Namco. For those who don't know, it's a really, really gory side-scrolling beat-em-up, if you like, or slash-em-up. And the general story, you play a kid called Rick Taylor. Again, his girlfriend basically gets stolen. They go to this shelter of this spooky house because it's typical, you know, fair, all sort of storm and rain outside, and they go into this house. Little do they know it's the West Mansion House, which is also known as the Splatter House, which is run by sort of like, it's like hell incarnate. And when they get in there, Rick is knocked unconscious and his girlfriend is taken away screaming. And then Rick, bizarrely, finds this hell mask, or terror mask as it's called, which looks strangely like a hockey mask, not too similar to Jason the horror films. And but he puts it on, and then he can sort of take the power of this terror mask to go attacking all the demons and what have you to rescue his girlfriend. And it's just great fun. I mean, I don't know what you guys thought, but you know, when you pick up that cleaver and you sort of like slice the enemies in half, and then you get that 2x4 piece of wood and you're smashing the enemy into the back wall, and really imaginative enemies. And I got very far in this game. It's not too bad in the early levels once you get used to it. And again, it's. Yeah. It reminded me a lot of games like Karate Champ and things, where there's like a constant stream of enemies, but you just, as long as you get your timing right of, you know, duck and kick or punching at the right time, it's not too difficult, certainly on the early levels. I mean, what did you guys think about it when you played it?
I love this and the series in general. I mean, it's one of those titles that if you played it as a particularly young person, you felt a little bit naughty playing it. Like, you really probably shouldn't be playing a game like this where you can like smack people into the background and they just explode into a massive group of blood and whatnot, and it's a beautiful love letter to classic horror movies in general, because you're fighting baddies like imitations of Leatherface and whatnot, and it just ticks all the right boxes. And the only sad thing about this series in general is probably not enough people have played it, because it didn't really come out on so many of the super popular machines in the West. Like, it never made onto like a Super Nintendo, for instance. Splatterhouse 2 got onto the Mega Drive, but the original Splatterhouse was mostly
TurboGrafx,
arcade and TurboGrafx confined. So just not so many people in Europe have played these games as much as they should have done or deserve to be played, which is a bit of a shame.
One of the double shames is, even if you played it on the TurboGrafx, the US version, they changed the colour of the mask. I presume they got cold feet that perhaps the main character looked a little bit too much like Jason from the Friday the 13th film. So they were a little bit wary of that, and so they changed it to sort of like this weird sort of, I think it's pink in colour. It certainly looks rather strange. It sort of takes you out of it. It's a red mask, isn't it? It's not pink. It's like a red mask.
Have you ever seen the cover for the TurboGrafx 16 version?
No, I've not. Is it really quite iconic?
Because it's quite a gory game, they had to put a content warning on the cover. It basically says something along the lines of, this game is too horrifying for young children and cowards.
But as I say, some of the weapons in this, I mean, I'll just list them off. You've got the cleaver, but there's a machete, there's a harpoon, chainsaw, shotgun, lead pipe, you know, an axe. I mean, pretty much the who's who in sort of Psychos R Us emporium of weapons are lined up for you to enjoy. And it's got real clever moments. I don't know how far you guys got in it. The first thing I'll say is, actually, when I played the first level, I was stuck. You know when you get to that first end level boss with all those sort of like alien worm things, like the little alien babies that's coming out at you. Do you remember that bit?
Yeah.
I kept on dying there, and then it suddenly twigged as a useful tip, because a lot of people will get stuck on this perhaps if they're like me. If you just stand in the bottom left hand corner and just keep on kicking, you can beat that end level boss. And once I got through that, I got quite far. And there's some really clever, I don't want to ruin too much, but some really clever scenes. There's like a later boss, there's a poltergeist boss. So you have like chairs, and so if you imagine like a room and all the flappers are going, just like, you know, like all the windows and the curtains and everything is sort of shaking, just like, you know, in any sort of classic horror movie. And then intermittently, you know, a chair or something will fly towards you, and you have to be ready for it. I just thought it was such a clever boss encounter, really imaginative. And another cool scene, and I hope this isn't can you say it's a spoiler when it's a really old game? There's another scene with a reflection of mirrors, and it's your reflection as you're walking along, and it's mirror after mirror after mirror, and you just know something's gonna come. And of course you get like an evil reflection suddenly, who then bursts through, and you're fighting yourself. I thought that was just a really cool touch as well. Yeah, I mean, what did you guys get reasonably far with it, or did you get sort of stuck quite early on?
I find these games are pretty darn difficult. I think they break you in very gently, and then suddenly the difficulty gets ramped up pretty high. Some of the boss battles are incredibly difficult on it without using cheats. But I think that people should be more brave and make more games like this these days. I mean, we don't really have anything I can think of off the top of my head that is vaguely similar to this. It's come out in the last 5 or 10 years. It's quite a unique piece. Really.
No, it's good. Did anyone actually play the... Because they did a new version of Splatterhouse, didn't they?
No, I don't like playing new versions of games. I find that they just spoil the memory of the original. Yeah. But speaking of the older ones, I don't know if you noticed whilst you were at Play Expo, but there was a couple of copies of Splatterhouse 2 knocking around on the Mega Drive, and they're fetching a reasonably high price, so this must be quite in vogue at the moment.
That's really cool.
A lot of people seem to be out to get this game, which I'm quite pleased with. I'd like to see more people enjoying Splatterhouse, particularly at this time of year. It's a classic.
And for those who don't know, I mean, the guy behind this is Shigeru Yokoyama. He's the guy who did Design Time Crisis and went on, you know, still at Namco doing sort of games like Rage Racer and R4 and the PS1. And he also was behind the Klonoa games, which is, if you've never heard of, Klonoa is probably one of the best platform games of all time, in my opinion. Such a great hidden gem on the PlayStation. So he's a real talented guy, the guy behind behind this. I mean, mostly producing a lot of those games, but you know, he obviously picked and chose some of Namco's best that he worked on.
Absolutely,
good knowledge.
But very, very cool. One other thing that I did notice actually on the Splatterhouse, talking about the series, I was reading on, I think it's called the West Mansion website, which is like a fan site all about Splatterhouse. And one of the facts that they said, which I didn't know, the actual first port of Splatterhouse was on the Famicom. And it was called Splatterhouse One Puka Graffiti. And it's kind of like, I had a go on it, and it's really cute. It's like a cute parody version of Splatterhouse. And it's a lot of fun. It's well worth sort of tracking down. And because it's one that probably, because I think it only came out on the Famicom. When in fact it did, only came out on the Famicom. So it's one that will have passed a lot of us by. So it's a real hidden gem there. If you just want to play everything in the series, it's well worth tracking down.
Cool. I'll tell you one of the things I did like about this game. I did play it a bit. But I wanted to, it was pretty damn hard, so I did have a look on YouTube as well to see what actually happens in the game further on.
Yeah.
And I found a clip right at the end of the game, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, is at the end of the game, you're about to rescue your girlfriend, and then she suddenly turns into like a great big ugly monster that you've got to fight. I thought that was genius.
it's really evil humour, isn't it, really? That the ultimate sort of slap in the face. That's
you've spent the entire game trying to get to this point.
So sorry we ruined it for everyone.
Oh, yeah, come on.
But it's an old enough game, isn't it? But no, you're right, that is such a clever ending, I thought. That was really, really good.
Brilliant twist.
Yeah, fantastic. But I suppose we're going to go rattling on to the next game, and I'm very excited for this. But before we hit the game itself, shall we play some of its music, because I think it's a real gem of the title music is absolutely awesome. That game, as you heard there and probably guessed, is The Addams Family, released by Ocean in 1992 on practically every system known to man. And this was your choice, was it, Steve, I believe?
Yeah, it was indeed.
Yeah, and so do you want to do the honours and sort of tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, no problem. So it was made by Ocean, who obviously had quite a history of making TV shows and films into games, but the Addams Family, I mean the platform I'm talking about that it's on and the one I played it on was the Amiga.
Yeah.
But it's definitely one of the better platformers on the Amiga. It was obviously based on the famous TV series, but
well, the film really wasn't it, because the film
sorry
well at the same time
yeah
TV originally, but it was
and then a film. to me, it was like it was in the mold of sort of, it was a Mario style platformer. One of the things I found quite difficult when you first start playing the Addams Family, though, is that your main character, he slides. Doesn't matter whether you're on grass or outside or you're inside the house and just on normal floor, he's got this sort of like a bit of like gravity to him, so when you run and stop, he doesn't stop, he slides like, you know, half a foot, and that can like be really bad if you're trying to jump from small platform to platform. So you need to sort of learn when you first start playing it. You'll find yourself dying quite a lot because he just slides off the edge of platforms and stuff, and it's only once you get used to the momentum that you actually get, you know, start getting good at the game. But yeah, it's, you know, it's a tough game, and it gets a lot harder as it goes on.
It's huge as well, isn't it? I mean, it's such a massive game to play. The levels and that are just immense, aren't they?
Yeah, well, you basically sort of wander around the Addams Family house, don't you? And each room inside the house is like, it's basically a level. And you can also like go outside. There's a garden, the haunted tree.
Yeah.
And I found, I mean, there's, it's a nice looking game. There's a nice variation sort of in the enemy sprites. There's like spiders, weird rabbit things, strange creatures with
psycho
shells.
Chefs. And,
yeah, yeah. Shells with spikes on their backs.
Yeah.
Secret doors scattered around the levels. It had a basic sort of health system, so you had two hearts for health, so you could take two hits before you died. Unfortunately, his armor doesn't come off because he's not wearing any. Some of the later levels, they've got like spinning blades and guillotines and spikes. So it's, you know, it took a fair bit of skill to get through the game, and as you say, it was quite a big game as well. But what did you guys think of it?
Well, I played the SNES version originally back in the day because I didn't have an Amiga. And if you compare it to, say, something like a Mario All-Stars, it doesn't compare terribly favourably, so it's not a good comparison to make. But back on the Amiga, you didn't have a massive plethora of quality platformers. You had stuff like Zool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing I would say, and you're absolutely right there, Matt, is, you know, for us on the Amiga, where we didn't have, you know, for console owners, they would be probably scratching their head a bit of, you know, why we see this game so fondly. But, you know, we didn't have the Marios and we didn't have Sonic and what have you. So to have finally a half-decent platformer that basically was, well, about as close as you can get to Mario without being sued, as Great Yarn Assistants found out. it was just a great title, and it was just, Steve sort of hit upon, just the imagination of all the enemies that you were taking on, and it just everything, wasn't it? And you had that flying Fez hat. It was just really crazy throughout, but my word, it's so frustratingly difficult. I mean, I was playing it on, I tried it on the Amiga again, just to remind myself. But I also happened to, when I bought my SNES quite recently, it came with loads of games with it. And one of the games was the Addams Family. So, of course, for the nature of the podcast, I put it in the SNES and cranked it up. And it is a beautiful version on the SNES. For those who remember it on the Amiga, it's great going to the SNES version because you actually see the backgrounds as well. They add in extra elements, so it's a great version of that. But you still can't beat, there's just something about playing it on the, for me, the original, you know, the Amiga and everything like that, that was just wonderful, really. But yeah, on both versions, so frustrating. The bits with the spinning, you got the guillotines and the spinning spikes and the amount of deaths going through. I mean, I even, for shame, on the SNES version, I found there was a cheat code that gave you 100 lives. And I still couldn't complete the game. I got very far, but I couldn't complete the game, for my shame. And I'm probably deservedly will get a lot of people making fun of that. But but yeah, it's just that was that rock hard. It reminded me of games like what was that game, Steve, that I think you mentioned that you had 100 lives.
Thousand and One Spikes.
It reminded me of that game because it was
pretty similar.
There I was with all those lice and I was still struggling to beat it.
Well, it's a good game. Like I can say, it's a good game. I mean, Ocean, like Matt said there, did really well using the license, but you could strip the license away from this and it's still a good game.
Yes, yeah.
It doesn't need the unique selling point because it's actually a good game.
And absolutely stuffed with secrets. I mean, it was amazing, you know, how many sort of like hidden rooms and, you know, just simple things like, you know, when you're outside of the house, right at the beginning, you know, you go left and you're like, you can see a flying fez hat. And you don't necessarily sort of hit on it straight away because there's like a hanging gallows with the rope and the noose. And, you know, you often, particularly on Amiga days, you'd think, oh, that's part of the background, you know, it's non-interactable. But you find, you know, you can jump onto the gallows rope and climb up and get the fez hat. And then you're like flying above the house. And you can go down the chimneys and find hidden rooms. And it's one of those, for those who love, like, collecting everything like me, it's one of those you keep you going for forever, to be honest, because there's so many hidden items and things to find. And it does get less frustrating and more enjoyable when you find more hearts as you continue to play. But yeah, so some of the level design I found frustrating. It's like when you go into one of the rooms, for example, there's like choose left or right, and you say go left, and it's you go through a horrible platform, really tough, you know, you lose loads of lives, and then you think, oh, I finally get to the end level boss, you beat the end level boss, and you don't actually find one of the members of the family that you're supposed to find. You get an extra heart, and I was just like, for God's sake, you know, it's like I've just gone through that, I've lost about sort of like 20 lives and that's all I we may well get. But I suppose for those who you know, didn't have too many games back in the day, you certainly got your money's worth with this. It's very well worth the play.
I think it's a theme though, isn't it, running through most retro games, and that's that they were bloody hard.
Well, I thought it was that we're no good at games. I thought that was a running theme.
Well, and that.
But you're right. I think there's a lot of games are rock hard. But then, you know, you think, oh, it's rock hard, impossible. And then, like you mentioned with Ghosts and Goblins, I keep saying ghouls and ghosts, with Ghosts and Goblins, you meet someone that, yeah, there he was on level 6.
Yeah.
So clearly people do have the skills. It's just something I certainly don't possess.
Us.
Yeah. It's actually always a running joke with some of my friends that I'm so into games and know everything about them, but I'm so crap at them.
you don't have to be good at them to like them, Paul.
Well, I suppose, should we go on to another game?
Let's do it.
Yeah, this is another listener contribution, and it's the classic Alone in the Dark, released in 1992, and it's done by Blake Brett, aka Phoenix Z80.
Hi guys, my name's Blake, otherwise known as Phoenix Z80 on the Retro Asylum forums. I want to talk to you about the game Alone in the Dark. It came out in 1992 on PC and a few other different formats as well. But I first came across this game when I was in a computer shop. I went with a friend and we were looking around. There's quite a big computer store, Icon Computers, and they had two machines set up kind of like at the back of the store in almost like a bit of an alcove playing games. I can't remember what was on the other machine, but on the one that I went on to, it was Alone in the Dark. I'd never played this game before. Started a new game, and then it starts playing the introduction to it. Without going into too much detail, basically it's a haunted mansion, and you play a private investigator, and the game starts with you arriving in the car and then walking down the path and walking up through this haunted mansion, and then you finally take control of the player when he reaches the attic. Very the amount of suspense that was in the introduction, I'd never seen before in a game. It, in some ways, it's very similar to the kind of virtuality machines that were around at the same time. I think the level of detail that were in the graphics were enough at that time for me to start believing more that the game was real life. I mean, if you look at the graphics now, it's ridiculous, and the animation, it's not in time. When he's going up the steps, his feet appear to be like floating above the steps as he's walking up there. But at the time, it was the best you'd ever seen. And with the kind of music in the background, and you get up into the loft, and it's you're kind of watching a video. You finally take control of your player, and then within the first 60 seconds of the game, you don't know what you're doing. Well, I didn't. The trapdoor opens, a zombie pops up, the music starts playing, you get panicky, you start running around, and eventually the zombie kills you. When the game finished, or when I died, I didn't want to play it anymore. So I got a little bit scared. And like I say, it's ridiculous when you look at what some of the games are like now. But if you get a chance, go onto YouTube, have a look at the introductory video, and you can definitely see where some of the ideas for later games like Resident Evil and a few other like zombie scary type games came from. Definitely the first game that kind of made me scared, and I just wanted to talk to you about that. Anyway, thanks for listening. Bye.
Yeah, well, that's a real sort of classic, and thanks for that contribution. Alone in the Dark is certainly like the granddaddy 3D survival horror game, isn't it? It is the thing that I think later games like Resident Evil really do owe a lot to. Have any of you guys sort of played Alone in the Dark at all?
I played it way back when.
Yeah.
And I must admit, it's been that long. I don't remember a huge amount about it other than thinking at the time that it was absolutely amazing, because it did seem like a massive leap forward in terms of what was going on at the time. And it's one of those games that's so universally acceptable. It's on so many formats, particularly like early CD-based consoles, that just about everyone's had the chance to experience it at least once during their gaming lifetime, if you like. So, yeah, definitely a special one. Just a shame it's one of these classic video game horror titles that makes very bad movies. If you've ever seen the film of this, my word.
No, I've never actually seen the movie. I heard it was really bad.
Don't do it.
Well, what about you, Steve? What did you think?
I mean, I didn't play it back in the day. As he's just said there, have a look at it on YouTube, so I did. Mm-hmm. I can see exactly what you're saying there. I mean, it's definitely laid down the blueprints for the likes of Resident Evil. You can see how they've done the specific camera angles and the different shots. I mean, it hasn't aged particularly well looking at it now, but if you take into account what it was doing, and it was one of the first to do that, you can see that it was like, you know, really well thought out, really clever idea, concept. And I can see back in the day that would be scary the first time you ever played something like that.
Yeah, well, I remember sort of drooling over this game back in the day, but I mean, you know, 1992, I was squarely on the Amiga. So never really got a chance to play this until probably, well, I definitely remember playing it when I got a PC, so that would have been around university time, 94, 95 for me. It was getting old hat, but I knew from magazines and that how important it was, and I was desperate to sort of track it down and give the game a go, because I knew it was, you know, something special. And it really is, as you say, it hasn't aged well, but back in the day, those graphics were really, really impressive and
revolutionary at the time.
And for those who don't know, very much like, you know, your Biohazard or slash Resident Evil.
I'm so glad.
I know, I did it especially for you, Matt.
That means a lot to me. Thank you. Thank you.
Upset when people call it Resident Evil.
let me do a very, very, very quick story whilst you're on that particular point. When I was at Play Expo, I was at the Sore Thumbs training stall. And there was a girl going through a bunch of import Saturn games, as it was, actually. And she plucked out the Japanese Resident Evil Biohazard. She went, oh my God, I can't believe it was called this. That sucks. And I was like, first time I came close to having a stern word with a lady at a retro gaming convention, believe you me. It's like, that title only works for the first game. It doesn't make any sense thereafter. It's rubbish. It's called Biohazard. Deal with it,
woman. If you're listening.
Yeah. You know who you are. I gave her a look.
The stern.
Withering stare.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, do go on. But, sorry for
it. No, it is. It's. I had a go because I've got it on part of my GOG collection because I seem to collect them up as whenever they're on sale, I sort of pick them up and, you know, I went back to it because I knew this was one of the contributions. And it is. It's very impressive. You say it hasn't aged well. But the thing actually I found the scariest thing about it now isn't so much the sort of like the zombies and the enemies. It's the hero that you play. There's something about you play this sort of Victorian. He's got like a moustache, but with his angler face, and he's got those sort of like eyes staring to nothing in it, and emotionless face. It really sort of that was more walk. What creeped me out rather than the actual zombies and things coming towards me. Okay, well, we've got some real classics coming up here. Some of the last few sort of games we're going to be covering here, some of my favourite. That I really sort of fell in love with. The first game that I'm going to mention, which was Matt's choice, called D by Warp, released in, I think it was 1995, came on various systems, didn't it, Matt? Like the 3DO initially, and then went on to the Saturn and PlayStation. Do you want to say a little bit about it, Matt?
Oh, yes, I do. I'd always hoped I'd get a chance to talk about this one, because I haven't actually met many people in person who've played D, even though I regard it personally as a bit of a classic, although it's a little bit strange. But it's always been one of my personal favourite quirky games. I originally played it back in the day on the 3DO, which, for the record, is my favourite bad console of all time. So this sits right on top of the pile as one of its better efforts. But as you say, it was also on the Saturn and the PS1, and as far as I'm aware, they're pretty much identical, although I haven't actually played the PS1 version, but there's a good reason for that, which we'll come to a little bit later on. But in D, you play the role of Laura, who's the daughter of a doctor that's gone mad and killed all the patients in his hospital, and he's then subsequently locked himself away in his castle residence, as you do. And the police have sent you to coax Dr. Richter out of hiding. And when you start the game up, you'll notice right away that this is very different to other horror games of the time, if you compare it to, again, Resident Evil, Biohazard, or Alone in the Dark, as we've just spoken about. Firstly, it's completely CGI rendered, which was fairly unique at the time. There wasn't many games doing that. I think off the top of my head, the only one I can immediately recall that did that particular technique pretty well was Myst.
And for fact fans, it was on 3 Amigas that they did it on.
Yes,
the full motion.
That's correct. Yeah, it was all rendered on 3 Amiga computers, which is pretty impressive in itself. But unlike Myst at the time, rather than clicking around to move, you are in the third person view. First person view, I beg your pardon, and direct your character one move at a time. So you push forward on the D-pad and you take a few steps forward, and then you stop at intersections where it gives you the opportunity to change direction, either left, right, back, or forward, as you so many choose. So it's a little bit slow and plodding, but you're eventually getting around. And on that basis, it's fairly basic, which effectively makes D more of an interactive movie than a game. But please, whatever you do, don't let that put you off. You know, there's some good stuff underneath that initial basic layer. So where the game for me is quite unique is in the game's events are all happening in real time, and you have literally 2 hours to complete the whole game. If you don't do it within 2 hours, you die. Or the game ends, essentially speaking. And everything that goes on in the game world is constant, and that includes not being able to pause. So it's a full 2-hour intense experience, and you have to keep going forward as you go. There's no relent in the gameplay whatsoever. But whilst it's a fairly short game, you need to dedicate a certain amount of time to play it through, with it being a 2-hour experience. There's not a whole lot of replay value there beyond unlocking some alternative endings, but it is a game I like to revisit every few years because it did have a big wow factor for me when I first played it back in the day. So just like a good horror film, really. It's not something you're going to watch again and again, but you're going to dig it out of your collection every couple of years and give it a run through. But it's genuinely disturbing and entertaining. Whilst not having some of the jump scares in it like in Resident Evil, it does have some really gruesome scenes and generally gets your blood pumping as, like I say, a constant 2-hour experience. But whilst it's a favourite of mine, it's more the lore behind D and its developer Warp, as Chris mentioned, it's even more fascinating. I don't know if you guys know about Warp particularly much, but it was headed up back in the day by the talented programmer Kenji Ino, and he's one of the few Japanese base teams that were really backing the 3DO upon its release. And D was their first really big hit, and was particularly big in Japan across the 3DO, Saturn and PlayStation. And at that point, Acclaim decided to snap up the rights to distribute it in America and in Europe. It didn't have quite the same amount of impact in the West, unfortunately, and this was in light of some interesting tactics by Kenji Ino to beat censorship, whereby he submitted a censored down version of the game so it would get a low rating, and just as it was going to print, switched it back to the full version, so people were getting like a rated teen version, but it was absolutely...
He sort of swapped it on the plane, didn't he? He sort of purposely made it late, wasn't it? So so he had to deliver it
very, very sneaky by him. That's right, yeah. So quite an interesting story in itself. And it's quite common on the Saturn, slightly less common on the 3DO because that's good stuff on there. It's just hard to find in general anyway. But it's actually quite rare on the PlayStation in its English release. I actually saw this going for £40 at PlayStation.
Do you know the reason for that,
Matt? Not too many of them knocking it.
Yeah,
we're just getting to it now. This was because Sony botched an order for the game's manufacturer, whereby they only managed to print off 40,000 pieces of the game, which was to clear the pre-orders for the game. And this eventually led to Kenji Ino self-imposing an embargo on releasing games for the PlayStation, which, as we know, time will tell, that was a particularly bad idea, unfortunately for him and the success of his little studio. So as a result of that, Warp's next game, Enemy Zero, came out as a Saturn exclusive, and the sequel to D was lined up as a launch title for the now defunct Matsushita M2, which was going to be the sequel console to the 3DO. However, after them putting out some cool demos of what D2 was going to be like, it never saw the light of day in its original form and was ultimately scrapped. The D2 did eventually come out on the Dreamcast, but it ultimately was quite a different game to what was originally intended for the M2, which is a bit of a shame. But Warp, they are a very unique little studio and have a particular style of doing games. Unfortunately, they're not still going out, which I find a little bit sad. But D in itself is a very trailblazing game, quite unique in the horror genre, and has a ton of legacy behind it. So if you've never experienced it before, don't go on YouTube and check it out and spoil it for yourself. Try and dig out a copy on the cheap. I promise, at least for a short playthrough, it's a really nice, fun experience.
Yeah, I mean, I actually picked this up on the Saturn, actually. Because it's one of the games that I thought I had, but I didn't.
It's the easiest format.
I like building up my Saturn collection. It's still quite expensive on the Saturn, to be honest. But it's one that I think it helps if you were seeing it back in the day, a bit like Alone in the Dark, really, where you know to see it with sort of like more modernized without the nostalgia. It's because it is, as you say, very, very slow, and the puzzles aren't particularly great, but there is a certain sort of charm. I mean, for those who don't know, it's it is sort of in real time, but you're sort of very sort of plodding and sort of stepping through. One thing to add, though, is the Saturn and the PlayStation version, you might be interested in this, Matt, it does have the extra elements. The 3DO had two versions, I believe, which was the D and the D, the director's cut. And mm-hmm. The Saturn and the PlayStation has a lot of the scenes from the director's cut, so I was interested when you were describing it that she goes to the castle, because on the Saturn version she goes to the hospital, sees everyone sort of like dead, thinks, "Oh my god!" And you know, although that never made sense to me why the police send her in after a mass murdering dad. But then there's like you get like a shimmering like warp thing that swallows her whole, and that's how she ends up in the castle. And that sounded a bit different from what you described. So I just wondered if it's different opening.
It's one of those things where it's not clear right at the very start, but it does become clear as you go along that it's an outer sort of dimensional experience. So whilst weird things are going on in this world of no rules, if you like, strange things are going to happen, which, like this warp scenario that you've just described. So, yeah, that makes sense, even if it doesn't make sense.
It is good. As you say, it has a bit of creepiness, but I just found it a bit slow and plodding. What about yourself, Steve? Have you had a look at this one, or did it...
I have one. I mean, I haven't got 3DO or Saturn emulator for the Mac, so I just had to look at it on YouTube, which is what Matt just said, don't do. And I'm probably going to piss on Matt's chips a little bit here, but I found it hard work. And I think it's because of the really slow movement and the sort of slow transitioning around like already like rendered clips. I think probably at the time it looked amazing. And I think it's probably at the point where they were still trying to work out what they could do with CD-ROMs and make new experiences for people. And that was like one of the first steps along the ladder there of like, you know, pre-rendering cutscenes and having you move through them. But I think personally, I mean, I didn't play it at the time, didn't know much about it at the time, so I've just come from it like fresh. And I did find it a bit of hard work. The footage of it sort of reminds me of like the TV show Nightmare. And like I say, the graphics levels probably is like close to what I think like Tomb Raider on the PlayStation 1. Sort of graphically, that's what the graphics level, except that it was all Tomb Raider was done in engine and live, whereas, you know, D is all pre-rendered. So for me, it doesn't look like it aged well, and it was slow and a bit of hard work. But I can also appreciate the fact that if you understand the backstory of it, understand where it came from, and knew about it at the time, that it could be something that is like, you know, has a real good nostalgia kick to it. But just for me, just coming from a totally fresh, just looking at it, I was just like, this is painful. I'll tell you why. It's one of my massive pet hates, because I test games for a living, is long cutscenes. I absolutely can't stand them. I mean that in the modern sense as well. In modern games, especially unskippable cutscenes, drive me insane. You know, it's just like, I just want to play this, stop putting this crap in front of me that I'm not interested in. I'm trying to get past it. So I've sort of built this sort of aversion to looking at that kind of stuff. And this whole game was kind of that kind of stuff. But like I said before, you know, I can see why if you did love it back in the past, and you did appreciate it. I don't want to take that away from people. I think what Matt just said there is right, that if you want to have a go of it, maybe go off and play it properly as opposed to just look at it as a video like I just did. Because I couldn't get hold of like an emulator on the Mac for the 3DO or the Saturn. But if anyone knows of one and wants to tell me on the forums of good Mac, Saturn and 3DO emulators, please do.
I'm part of the PC master race. Sorry, Steve.
The inferior PC race. What are we up to? We'll have,
I can give you some brilliant
wars.
Emulators for the... But I bought the actual game, but I totally get where you're coming from, Steve. But then having said that, I think, you know, if you play it back in the day, I was with a friend of mine, Steve, and he did different Steve to yourself, but he remembered it on the Saturn, and he absolutely loved it. He was trying to, he was so enthusiastic about this game. Like Matt, he was just like saying, "Oh, it was just because it's so different and it's so, you know, there was nothing else like it." And he just had such fond memories of it. So I can understand, and that's one thing you will always say about Warp. They created really unique, quirky games that was just totally unlike anybody else at the time or since, to be honest, isn't it? I mean, another classic they did was Enemy Zero as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, that game's quite unique in itself. It's a sort of space-based, first-person viewpoint game, again, with a horror element built in. So the closest thing you can compare it to more recently is something like Alien Isolation.
Yeah.
That's quite a generous comparison, but as I say, it's the closest thing you can compare it to. And again, at the time, no one was really doing games like that. Those sort of games started coming slightly more frequent in the PS3, Xbox 360 era, but back then, very cutting-edge stuff. Very innovative, and generally Warp did games very differently to how other people were doing them at the time. So again, if you're looking back on it with nostalgic eyes like I do, it's great. If you're looking at it with fresh eyes, it probably isn't going to wow you at all. But it's one of those ones, if you're a big fan of the horror genre, it's definitely worth taking a shot at if you can find it on the channel.
One thing I'd say, I mean, don't particularly take my opinion into account, because it's not my type of game. As a gamer, I am impatient. I've always liked sort of shoot 'em ups, fast games that get to the point, games that get to the gameplay straight away. And I'm not one for sitting through cutscenes, sitting through films, sitting through backstories. Like I said before, looking at maps. For me, it's about gameplay and getting stuck into something quick and enjoying it. So, you know, I am biased in that sense. So by all means, like, the listeners shouldn't listen, you know, take my opinion on board by all means, but definitely go and check it out as well. Because if you like that style of thing, that style of game, then you may well really enjoy that.
Yeah, and
it's definitely slow and plodding, but a lot of survival horror games are. So if you're into that kind of thing, then this won't phase you necessarily.
Now I want to go on to the next title, and this is as Matt was so enthusiastic about D, this is one title that I've absolutely adore. I think it's a real gem of a game called Realms of the Haunting. Now, we try to keep away from PC games for the sake of poor Steve, because he's only got a Mac, bless him. So
I can't wait until about 30 years from now when we have the 128-bit wars. Me versus you. Mac versus PC.
But for those, this was a game that passed a lot of people by, called Realms of the Haunting, as I say. Released in Europe, it was released in 1997. And it's an absolute gem of a game. It's like a horror first-person shooter, but it's just so creepy. And for those who don't know, it's actually done by Anthony Crowther, who many will know from Gremlin. Did ton. Well, this is a Gremlin game as well. But you know, Anthony Crowther did the Monty Mole C64 conversions, and he also did like Potty Pigeon and Amiga owners will remember games like Bomboozle and Captive. I certainly did the sequel Captive 2 Liberation, and then he went on to PlayStation titles like N2O and things. He's always done gems of a game, and he's a really nice guy. One of the thankfully went and was able to meet him when they turned up at the Play Expo in Blackpool, not this year, but the year before. He's just such a nice, down-to-earth person. Anyway, this game, Realms of the Haunting, is just so, so creepy. You basically play a guy called Adam Randall, who enters a haunted house to investigate the disappearance of his father. That's kind of how it's set up. But it has really, really clever integration of full motion video. So it's using actual video clips. But the way that they do it means because they're sort of against CGI, it's not that much of a transition when it goes back to the game engine. It's not that jarring. It's very clever how they sort of do it. And the actual game engine itself is just amazing. Really good lighting, you know, it really makes good use of the light. I mean, to give you an idea, when you first walk into the haunted house, you know, this house, it's all dark, you know, it's one of those games you really feel freaked out and trying to find the light switch. There's like thunder and lightning going on outside and that sort of temporarily lighting up the place. And it's just one of those games that really, really creeps me out. To the point, and they really, I had a games night with a couple of friends. So I had like three friends dotted around, and they were all playing different things. And I said, "Oh, I'm going to play this just to remind me." So there I am. I'm not even by myself, and they found it hilarious because I suddenly let out a little girly scream. And got genuinely creeped out, even just playing the game just the other week. which I think says more that I'm a wimp, actually, when it comes to horrors than anything. But in fact, the opening levels, I think, a lot better once you start going. It's still very good, but once you start going into like the catacombs underneath, there's like massive complex, I find that less spooky. But it's very much like a slower paced Doom, and you're sort of carefully using your a bit like Resident Evil or Biohazard, I should say, for Matt's sake. You know, ammo is quite limited, so you're really trying to use it sparingly. Have you guys played it at all?
I actually think I played this back in the day. I remember my mate had one of them rubbish PCs that you're talking about. we used to go around back in the... When did it come out? What was the year?
1997 in Europe. I mean, it came out in the tail end of 96 in America.
I think I've got a recollection of going around to my mate's house watching the Fast Show. And he had this game, but it was great. It looked fantastic at the time. For me, it looked a bit like sort of Doom in a haunted house. But like you say, great lighting. You know, the textures really impressive for a game back. You know, of that age. I like the woman, Rebecca, who turns up to help you, but you only really see her in the cinematic clips. But then I think was there a voiceover? She'd still help you within the game. You wouldn't see her. You just hear the voiceover.
I don't remember those bits. Your father turns up. He does a bit like D, where he starts warning you, leave the house. And I always hate that, actually, with both D and this one. Your father turns up in like spectral form. Same thing happens in D. Says, leave this place. You don't want to be here. And, you know, in real life, I'd be out that door.
Straight away.
But you're like, damn, the door's locked. Why can't I get out? But, I don't know. Maybe I didn't get far enough. I mean, I did play and get... I think I've gone very far in the game, really. So I don't know. Maybe you're thinking...
I might have it wrong. Yeah. Don't worry. I'm recalling from 1997.
Yeah, so it was a long time ago. Have you tried this game at all or not?
No, you've actually plucked a PC game out that I've not played. So congratulations on that one. But I imagine this would go quite nice in my PC big box.
Yeah, you definitely want to track this.
It sounds
down.
Like a great concept.
You definitely am. And for those who I'm going to plug it. I really don't work for GOG. I know I keep mentioning them, but I do think their work is brilliant. But this is another game that GOG.com have. So that's a great cheap way of giving this game a go. I think it still holds up as one of the really solid first-person shooters. But there's even more than that, because it's not just like your Doom. There's lots of like letters and things to find, giving you real backstory of what's going on. I'm probably a bit like Steve, as I get a bit impatient with you know, you see the whole letters of written text and it's like, bah, I want to go on shooting. Skip. But it's at least it's there, you know, and there is just silly little things like you wander around the corner and something will jump out at you, and just that very clever balance of, you know, really always worrying about your ammo and whether you're going to run out, because my word, if you do run out, you're in trouble. I'll put a link, but there is like a fan site, because it is a rock hard game. There is a wonderful fan site for Realms of the Haunting, has all the information and loads of cool things about the game. And one of the things that was invaluable when I went back to it now, they did have some saves, different saves, where you could still from the beginning. But they've sort of hacked just to give you a little bit more ammo and lives. They had ones where it was like almost infinite, but I don't want to ruin the game. But they had ones that where it was a reasonable amount for gamers such as myself that aren't as good. I felt I had more of a fighting chance. But yeah, this is, as far as I'm concerned, a real hidden gem, and one that you really ought to track down if possible.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, we're coming up to our final game, and I can't remember who suggested Nightmare Creatures, because I'm forever thankful to you. Was it you, Steve?
It was me.
Yeah, I'm so thankful with Nightmare Creatures. I'll let you describe it. I mean, I'll just say it came out in 1997 on the N64 and PlayStation 1, certainly. Did it come on PC possibly as well? And I think in Europe, wasn't it SCEE, which I think is Sony, isn't it?
Who you work for now,
isn't it? And
he's picked it. And Sony Computer Entertainment.
Right, yeah, Calypso Entertainment was the developer, but
Calista.
Yeah. So I'll let you describe it, but I will say absolute gem. I really love this.
Well, when we were trying to pick games for this Halloween thing, initially I was just thinking of what's spooky, what's scary, you know, the obvious ones: Silent Hill, Resident Evil. Was all coming up, and then it popped back into my head. Now, I remember playing this on my PlayStation 1, which I bought the second year of university. So that would be 95, 96?
Yeah.
No, 97. It must be 97.
97, because of the game.
97, yeah. Now, my PlayStation cost me an absolute fortune, because I'd got to Newcastle, I was in my second year, I got my student loan, and then I went to Dixon's in the first week and I bought this bloody PlayStation on a monthly payment scheme. Like an idiot. I reckon it must have ended up costing me about 500 quid. Soft arse here didn't just go and get the basic one with like one controller. I was like, oh, I can get it on the drip. I'll never pay for it. This is brilliant. I'll have two controllers and five games, please. Just got it. But anyway, a couple of weeks in, haven't got it, I saw this game, this Nightmare Creature, so I picked it up. And what a game it was. It was absolutely brilliant. It was sort of like a third-person perspective hack and slash, wandering around sort of the old streets of London. I remember the intro was the first, like, when you boot it up, there was this, like, sort of campy horror intro describing the mad scientist who's called Adam Crowley, who's gotten into the occult and started practicing horrific experiments on the bodies of the dead, and they've been unleashed into London, and your job's to sort of go around and kill them all. But I also remember the voiceover sounded like the same voiceover from The Trapdoor, the TV show, the kids' TV show. It's just like he.
Berkfield.
That's the one, yeah. So it's that sort of, the voiceover was like, what did he say? Something along unleashing a horde onto the streets of London. A horde of nightmare creatures. And then, like, which was just like, no one knows the horrors below the trapdoor waiting to get out.
I thought for a minute there you meant Bert. It sounded like Bert, you know. Or he looks a bit bonky.
He works alone, his hands defiling the bodies of the dead in his thirst for knowledge and power. His name is Adam Crowley, a man who was once respected in the field of science until fate led him along another path towards black magic.
Somewhere in the dark and nasty regions where nobody goes stands an ancient castle. Deep within this dank and uninviting place lives Burke.
Hello!
overworked servant of the thing upstairs.
Feed me!
But that's nothing compared to the horrors that lurk beneath the trapdoor. For there is always something down there, in the dark, waiting to come out.
Yeah, it was like, sounded like the same guy.
Yeah.
But it's such a cool game. So some info about it. So it was set in, the game's like set in London in 1834, and you can play as like a priest or this sort of hot chick. And your job's to defend London by killing all the creatures that have been created by the dead, by the mad scientist. Now the priest's got a staff and the chick's got a sword. And then you also sort of got secondary weapons like guns.
Yeah.
And like I say, the aim of the game is just to roam around London and kill all the creatures that have been unleashed. But even looking back at it now and having a go of it this week, it still aged pretty well. It still looks good.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. I mean, basically, as you described it, it felt very much like Tomb Raider, but much more action-y.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
And as you say, the opening level, you know, you sort of, you find yourself in this street and... You have this zombie, and as you say, I played the hot chick because she's hot, and I also tried the guy with the staff, but I struggled a bit more with him. But the hot chick's quite fast, so you sort of beat up and attack the zombie, and the zombie falls over. But the trouble is, the zombie will get back up, and even if you use a secondary weapon, like, and shoot the head off, which I think is brilliant, the way the head just like you shoot the actual head off, the zombie will still get up. They're absolute like beasts of a thing, So you're sort of going with that, but the had that scare right at the beginning, and it did make me jump initially. And sorry, but it's a spoiler right at the beginning. You go sort of round the corner, you know, things are relatively quiet, you're worried a bit about the zombie behind, and then through the door comes crashing out a really well-designed werewolf, and it's a proper werewolf, like, you know, not like the namby-pamby ones you get on a lot of video games. This is like a proper snarling werewolf come running at you, trying to bite you, and it really makes you go cough, you know, really jump a bit, certainly if you're a bit wimpy like me. But it's throughout the levels, isn't it? It's really nice variants to everything. You get docks later on. And good puzzles as well. I mean, very Tomb Raider sort of, you know, flick a switch to open a door, that kind of puzzle, or find an item. But yeah, I just loved it. And every level was something new and different, whether you're going down the sewers later on, or I love those sort of like sort of H.P. Lovecraft sort of Cthulhu creature things that come out of the lakes at you later on. I was just won over with this game. It was a game I just not on my radar at all. I'd heard of it, but I never sat down and really sort of played it, and absolutely loved it. And the fact that I've heard there's a sequel, I'm very excited as well.
A sequel's supposed to be pretty.
Yeah, so I've heard.
What, it's supposed to be not very good?
Pretty bad. Pretty bad.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, it's by Konami. Published by Konami. The sequel. It's the same team, but yeah, the reviews I remember at the time, it got incredibly low based off the fact the first one was
popular. You say that, Matt, because I was really surprised when I was looking up about this game. The reviews at the time were pretty average in a lot of ways. A lot, you know, some went on 7 or whatever, you know, not fantastic. It wasn't like your 9 out of 10s, and I found that really strange, because I personally, like Steve found back in the day, I just thought this was a really, really solid, fun game. So I just wonder. I'm still going to give this sequel a try. But one thing I will say, because I've got an EverDrive, I thought, I'll put on the N64 version. And it's terrible compared to the PlayStation version. It really, the camera seemed all over the place, and it seemed unfinished to me, quite glitchy. And this is me playing it, you know, not through an emulator or anything. This was playing on an EverDrive, so I was playing, you know, it wasn't emulating in effect.
Exactly.
So I did notice actually a lot of the N64 reviews were even worse than the PlayStation. But yeah, no, I was so chuffed you mentioned this, Steve, because it's absolute classic and one that I've had a lot of fun with, and I've already reserved it. I couldn't stretch to buy it, to be honest, with all the Manchester and everything. But my local retro game shop had it on the PlayStation, so I've got them to put it behind the counter for me. So as soon as I got a bit of money next week, I'm going straight up there to buy it.
Oh, brilliant.
But, yeah, so you've cost me money is what I'm saying, Steve.
That's what I thought. Good.
But, yeah. Well, we've certainly left probably the best till last, I think. Sorry, because this is the last one, isn't it? I said the last before. But, yeah... You tell us about it, Matt, and do you tell us about this gem of a game of Silent Hill, released in 1999?
Yeah. I think it's going to be probably one of the most revered games that we've covered in this session. And, of course, we're talking Silent Hill for the PS1, which was developed and published by Konami in 1999. Yeah. And it's often referred to as perhaps the joint greatest ever survival horror game alongside Resident Evil / Biohazard. But Silent Hill takes a very different slant on the genre, whilst Biohazard has a more science fiction approach. Silent Hill has strange overtones of occult worship and really preys on you psychologically. One of the greatest effects in the game is that it frightens you by preventing you from seeing almost anything beyond what's right in front of you. Which is, if you want to compare it to a film in the same sort of genre, something like The Blair Witch Project, whereby you almost see nothing, yet you're scared of the ambience and the atmosphere that's created around you, and that's what Silent Hill does to great effect. So just for anyone out there who hasn't actually played this before, you play the role of Harry. You're going on vacation to Silent Hill with your daughter, and you end up in a car crash, and your daughter's gone missing. You have to try and find her, but the inhabitants of the town have all disappeared, and something very strange is going on. And it's notorious for these fogging effects, whereby you can barely see anything outside of your immediate field of vision, which makes it slightly frustrating, but ultimately quite scary, because you don't see enemies until they're sort of right on top of you. So it creates this very tense atmosphere as you're playing around. And those familiar with Resident Evil will be familiar with the classic tank-esque control system, which I found going back to when playing this for this episode was really difficult to get used to again. I don't think that particular control system aged terribly well, but it suited the time the game came out just fine. But that in itself provides a little bit of additional challenge, because the sense of dread you get when you're about to encounter an enemy, you have to very quickly find your aim button and then use the action button to shoot, really gets your blood pumping. You have to be very, very fast, or the enemies can inflict huge amounts of damage to you very, very quickly. I personally find that the engine for Silent Hill now looks a little bit dated, even compared to Biohazard. It's certainly not as polished, in my opinion. But what the game suffers for in its aesthetics, it definitely makes up with tons of atmosphere. You know, the sounds of whimpering enemies and the radio that rattles whenever they draw close. It really ramps up the tension quite well. So it's adding a genuine sense of dread and horror into the game, rather than just an out-and-out gore fest like you might get in Biohazard. And one thing that I've always found, even back then, particularly disturbing, and what sort of helped add to the discomfort factor, for lack of a better word, is the use of children in the plot. I just found that extremely uncomfortable. The fact that, you know, you're wandering down alleys and going through the schools and these various rooms, and there's like blood splatter all over the wall, and ultimately you're looking for a child, and then there's all these demonic creatures are trying to get you, those weird little imp things with knives that just pod towards you, and the nurses, oh, it's really discomforting stuff.
Pretty grotesque, isn't it? All the elements. So, yeah. So, I mean, you really do see monsters from your worst nightmare.
Yeah, it really preys on anyone who's a little bit psychologically disposed.
I think that's a key word, isn't it? Like... psychological. The whole thing about this is it because I'll be honest, because I'm a bit squeamish with games. With horror games, I'd owned the second game because I knew it was a classic. But to be honest, it sat on the shelf. I'd never tried the original. It was just one of those games. I thought, I don't like getting scared, and it looked a bit horrific. And I'm so glad because of this podcast. I really sat down and got very, very far in the game. Through the school and all of that, so right the way through, pretty much, and it's just a brilliant game, but it really is one of those games that it does more than scare you. It's not like you're just your jump out scares. It's slowly, drip by drip, starts disturbing you, isn't it? It really sort of makes you. I mean, I felt different after playing long sessions of the game.
I think disturb is the right word for it, because back in the day when I played it, I got so far into it, and I was like, I just have to stop because this is just making me feel way too uncomfortable. So I totally appreciate where you're coming from.
Because it does, it gets slowly more and more disturbing as you go on. And one of the things I thought was so clever was, you know, when you find that radio? And that radio sort of is like a warning mechanism. It's like the equivalent of like the alien beeps, you know, when you're holding the device, tells you that there's creatures nearby. I just thought that was so clever, and that really built that tension and fear. That you knew something was around, because you could hear the radio sort of it's all static sound, but it will change when a creature or monster's near. I thought that was just genius, real genius of the game designers, of getting that tension up.
It's certainly a good way of having a trade off for the lack of draw distance that the PlayStation was kind of notorious for, but they use it to good effect in this game. The fact that you can't see what's coming, but you can hear it, and then it gradually gets louder and louder through the radio, provides... They're not like cheap scares, but it's something that you know is coming, and then as soon as it happens, you have to be ready to deal with it, otherwise you're going to die pretty quickly. And this is... It's one of those games that has multiple endings and rewards you for good play, so if you're able to go through it without dying... and getting through it within a certain period of time, you unlock the best endings, if you like. So survival horror has never been more appropriate for this game, because the better you play it successfully, you get rewarded with better endings.
And Silent Hill, the actual town, is very open as well. It's quite, although there's certain areas you have to sort of unlock to get your way through, but it is surprisingly open, isn't it? You really... It's not too much hand-holding you through it all. You're pretty much left to your own devices, isn't it? You know the general plan of where you need to go. I mean, what did you think about it, Steve?
I mean, there's not much more I can add there. You two guys have just actually nailed it. But I think it's absolutely fantastic design, isn't it? To take the limitations of the system that it was on and use them to its own strength instead. Like you say, the PlayStation 1 didn't have a fantastic draw distance, but to then implement that by, like, the character having a torch attached to his jacket and only being able to see a few feet ahead of where he's going is fantastic, because it uses it as a strength instead of a weakness. And the sound as well, to like really build up the atmosphere and the tension as you're approaching things, to hear it coming first and know you can only see a few feet ahead of yourself as well. You know, it was the forerunner to that whole style of game. It's like the original horror game when we moved into the sort of 3D generation.
Yeah.
It was the ultimate. I mean, what's the game on the PS3 that was set in space? Dead Space. Yeah. You know, there's the evolution right there. They're taking the same tricks. That was all the way back in Silent Hill. So that shows just how clever they were, you know, in the design to create something like that. And it's still so well renowned and well remembered. You ask anyone about any, you know, post PlayStation 1, well, from PlayStation 1 onwards, horror games, they always bring up Silent Hill.
Mm. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think with the sort of downfall of Konami now as a game producer, games like this are only going to become even more and more revered, because we know we're not going to get more Silent Hills, which is a bit of a shame. That this is going to become highly, highly sought after, and people will treat it with more reverency than it already deserved, which was extremely large anyway. But this is definitely one of the best PlayStation games, one of the best horror games, full stop. And it's definitely more of a thinking man's game compared to Resident Evil, Biohazard, I think, which is no
Resident
bad thing.
Evil, Matt.
And it's definitely... I'm trying to
get down with the kids, are you?
Yeah, something like that. But, I dare say it's pretty hard game to finish on your own on a dark night, as I was trying to in preparing for this episode. I still find it a difficult play, even though I finished it a couple of times in the past. The factors that make you uncomfortable in playing it don't dissipate over the years, unfortunately. It still has those very invigorated sensations of discomfort. I know we keep harking back to that word, but that's what it is, because there's no real cheap scares in it. There's no dogs bursting through windows or anything like that. This is just slow, built-up
tension.
Yeah.
Tension and discomfort. Yeah.
And psychological.
It's psychological. That is the key word, isn't it? It just, it does, and that's far, far more scary. As I say, I'm so glad, because it would have been one that I just never... You know, I'd always gone to other games because, as I say, I'm not too keen on the really scary and the grotesque and everything. But, you know, I mean, well, to show you how much I loved when I sat down and played the original, I already had the second game already, which I planned to... when I went to the local retro game shop on that game night, I also picked up Silent Hill 3 as well. So I'm planning over time to play my way through the series and then eventually get... I've heard the fourth one's not as good.
Yeah, I think connoisseurs of the series say that Silent Hill 2 is probably...
That's what I've heard. Well, I've got the... I think it's a director's cut or one of the special editions. I think maybe it just has a making of. But thank you for suggesting this, Matt, because as I say, it probably would have been a series that I know about because it's so famous, but one that I've never sort of properly sat down with.
Well, I don't think fans of the series would have forgiven us if we left this out of a Halloween or horror special, so... It was nice to revisit, and if anyone hasn't played it for a while,
check it out.
Go back and check it out. It's definitely good for a night's worth of horror.
I mean, that's the thing. There's so many classic horrors we did miss out. But then this isn't a comprehensive list, and hey, there's Halloween's for other episodes. I mean, one of the things is because of poor old Steve with his Mac, a lot of the horror games were on the PC, you see, so there was a lot of games that we couldn't choose because poor old Steve wouldn't have been able to try them. But
I'm gonna have to like downgrade and like dual boot, aren't I, to Windows?
Get some virtualization.
I might dual boot my iMac with Windows 10, and then
I still play Civilization 2 on my Mac through through virtualization.
But I might do.
So I think it was. I mean, that was a great list in terms of, you know. There is many, many other classics, but, you know, a lot, we tried to go a little off the rails, you know, with games that don't normally get a look in when it comes to around Halloween time. So I hope you all enjoyed. Yeah, okay, well, okay, guys, do you want to do any shout-outs before we wrap things up?
Yeah, I'd like to do a couple of just quick little shout-outs. Quick shout out to some of our ex-hosts, actually, Sam Dyer.
Yeah.
I think his Spectrum book is probably nearly complete.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm waiting for that. Yeah,
looking forward to getting
it back. And I also went for the tier where you get the box game. The I forgot what it's called now. That's terrible. I reviewed the game. It was brilliant. But yeah, that was. I can't wait to get.
Did you see the tier that comes in like what looks like a Spectrum box, an actual box?
No, well, I went for the tier with the Metal Max? That was what it's called, I think. The Spectrum game. So I'm going to get the actual box Spectrum game. I took the splurge for that because I did for Retro Asylum. I did a review of it, and I fell in love with the game. I thought it was such a brilliant Spectrum game that had been done. So the idea of like owning a limited edition, because it's only going to be done for this Kickstarter. So I thought it was worth putting up the extra to get the boxed version. And I've seen a picture of it, and Sam's done a brilliant job as always. But yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to that Spectrum book.
Me too. So a couple other quick shout-outs. So that was one to Sam. Ex-host Matt Wilshire. Me, Matt and Sam are hopefully going to be doing another episode soon, probably Commodore-related as usual. quick shout out to Ali. Wanted to see him at Play Expo, but you know, the Retro Hunter, but unfortunately he couldn't make it to this one, so he didn't get to say hello.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to give a shout out to Andy Godoy as well, because he always shouts out to us whenever he does his podcast, RGDS. So I just thought, you know, be nice, return the favour. So I'll give him a shout out as well.
Yeah, they've been doing some brilliant stuff there over there, haven't they?
So what about you guys? Any shout outs?
Yeah, well, I think it's worth shouting out. If we've done Andy, we ought to also shout out, you know, with Maximum Power Up and other ex-hosts, you know, Paul and Phil. It's nice, you know, the retro community and sort of sharing the love. But also my friends in the Retro Game Squad, those probably remember from the NES episode that
the American
I did
guys.
Them. Yeah, the American. Well, he's Canadian, but lives in America. just the nicest guys, and their podcast is absolutely awesome. So
well, we've had him on, haven't we? We've actually had him on the show.
Yeah, well, that was a really popular episode. People really were sort of blown away by, you know, how knowledgeable he was, and we couldn't have chosen for a better person to do the NES show with, because that was the episode. So it's
I've started actually listening to their show on the back of listening to him on our show, and it's brilliant.
Yeah,
it's absolutely brilliant. I love listening to their show.
Yeah,
and it's nice to get an American flavour as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we're hoping that because he had a blast last time, so we're hoping we could do another special with Alex again, because he was a real gent. And as you say, their show's well worth tracking down. So how about you, Matt?
Yeah, I've got a couple. I'd also shout out to the Retro Game Squad. I've really enjoyed listening to their stuff since Alex appeared on Retro Asylum. If you haven't checked out their latest Master System episode, give that a go. It's very, very educational if you're not an expert.
Brilliant.
On the Master
and it's
System.
About 3 hours long.
Yeah, it's really, really good. They went to town on that one. Also, shout out to Retro Gamer Daz, who, of course, is one of our Retro Asylum hosts, and we hope to have him back on the show real soon. And also, anyone who's unfamiliar with this particular channel, the Gebs24, who's a young lady who has a channel on YouTube and a great Facebook page, does lots of really good work for the retro community, and her content's really interesting, so definitely check her out.
Cool. And last shout out to all our listeners. Everyone, thanks for supporting us, and thanks to the guys who sent us some clips in for this show as well.
Yeah, you guys are all awesome. Okay, thanks. So let's wrap things up. Okay, guys, have a great Halloween and have a good one.
Take it easy.
Have no nightmares.